Chapter 10. Memorial's Ruin. The 500. Miracle.
There is some minor damage to the upper halls. Magos Carantine's servitor drones are checking the fabric of the walls. Some cracking, I fear. What effect this has had on the function of the beacon is unknowable.
I see you perfectly well, Warsmith, said Captain Casimir.
D'Antioch had to agree. The effects of the damage appeared minimal. The ruins of the Chapel of Memorial filled the stage, as it did whenever the Pharos was tuned to it, as real as if it occupied half the chamber of primary location Alpha and was not light years away. The black floor of the Pharos stopped. The chipped tiles of the chapel began. On the Macragge side of the divide, it was night. Forests of candles flickered atop layered candlestands as tall as Primarchs. Through the chapel's open roof, D'Antioch could see the angry red glow of the ruin storm, so much brighter there than at Sotha. Long use had made him an expert at reading the empathic field of the device. It fascinated and repulsed him equally, and he could scarcely believe it, but he could feel the anger of the sky. There was an overwhelming madness coming from the storm, the kind that would flood into him if he regarded it too closely. When he looked upon it, he had an inkling of what had overcome his brothers, and so he did not. He could also read Casimir as easily as if he were a book. Today, Valentus Dolor's equerry was as warm as always towards the Warsmith, but a guardedness had come over him when he had been told of their ranging efforts and Pollux's vision of Inwit. The Warsmith shifted in the audience throne. Failing to find a position that lessened the pain of his crooked back, he forced himself to remain still. Two of the Invictorus Guard waited by the broken arch of the chapel. They stood in perfect stillness at attention. That was a feat D'Antioch could no longer hope to emulate. The Warsmith's body was wrecked, destroyed by his own kin. When he walked, the pain was excruciating, but when he was still, it was worse. Pain nibbled constantly at the edge of his psycho-conditioning. He felt, as he had never expected to, like an old man used up by life. Only his will and the support of his battle plate allowed him to function at all. Iron within, iron without, he thought ironically. He would have laughed, but that was something else he had learned not to do too often, as it brought on racking coughs that ripped through his thorax in a storm of knives. Many who met him assumed he wore his Warsmith's mask to hide his disfigurements. To a very small degree, this was true, but only to a very small degree. D'Antioch was a man of the mind. He cared little for the aesthetics of his own form. The battered nature of his suit told that clearly. To those who asked, he said he wore it from shame, to remember who he was, so that he might never forget the treachery of his brothers. And this was also true. But D'Antioch did have pride. Pride in his legion and in his oaths that had kept him steadfast in the face of Crendel's betrayal at the Schadenhold. Pride had seen him wounded. Pride kept him masked. The pain of betrayal marked his face more than scars, and D'Antioch did not want his suffering to be remarked upon, only his deeds.
The conduit is open often, Captain Casimir. The machine has become accustomed to it. I and Alexis find it a simple matter to focus it there. The crag is not so far in galactic terms. If the Pharos has been compromised, then speaking with you is not an adequate measure to judge it by. So the question still stands. Do we continue our search for other operating beacons in order to extend the reach of the new Imperium here, as Lord Gilliman commanded, or cease our explorations to safeguard what we already have?
Sacrifice potential strategic superiority for established short-range capabilities. A difficult set of theoreticals to resolve, said Casimir. A decision of that importance can only be made by Lord Gilliman.
What of the Emperor Sanguinius? Said D'Antioch.
Lord Gilliman's orders are clear, said Casimir. He alone is to make decisions on matters pertaining to the beacon, no one else. Not even the Emperor would gainsay them without his consultation.
And can Lord Gilliman be reached?
Casimir's mouth twisted.
Not at this time.
The Primarch is occupied with matters of state.
I sense some dissatisfaction, Casimir.
Casimir grimaced.
They will not leave my Lord B. Every time the Pharos is fixed upon McCrag, more ships come in. All of them need to be greeted, their occupants appraised. Many of them are suffering from their betrayal. Gilliman attempts to help them all, but not all can be helped, and not all respond well to our way of doing things. Too many of them are at the mercy of their emotions.
He stopped, aware that he spoke ill of their allies.
I am scheduled to meet with Lord Gilliman later today. I will discuss your concerns with him then. Until then, you are to attempt no further long-range locational attempts. Once today's communications are finished, leave the beacon focused here on the Chapel of Memorial.
As you wish, Captain.
It is not as I wish. I wish this war had never started. I wish your Xenos machine could deposit us on the bridge of Horus's flagship so that we could end this war with one stroke. But wishes never brought a satisfactory solution to anything. I'm only being practical. Are you ready?
Yes.
Then I shall leave you to Consul Forsha's tender mercies. 20 communications today.
We shall attempt them all.
You have our thanks. I'm sorry to burden you, Sir Warsmith, but the government of the 500 worlds is dependent on your efforts. If there is anything we can do to ease your task, please have the Consul inform me.
Knowing the proclivities of your Legion and Ultramar, I would expect that you are already doing everything you can.
Casimir bowed. It is so, Warsmith. He addressed the guard.
Consul Forsha may enter. A formality, as there were no walls any longer between the chapel interior and the courtyard outside it. In primary location Alpha, Dantioch's small army of scribes prepared themselves. Forsha entered, flanked by human members of McCrag's precentral guard. A train of clerks and servants came with him, carrying heavy books, lecterns, tables, chairs, and data slates. A tent was erected within the ruin, portable heaters set up to drive off McCrag's chill. Quickly, and with the efficiency that Dantioch had come to expect of the 500 worlds, the Chapel of Memorial was ready for the day's business.
"Good day, Warsmith," said Forsha. He was not an old man by mortal standards, but the last months had been heavy on him. His skin was beginning to sag, and his dark hair was greying at the temples.
"I shall leave you to it. Other duties call," said Casimir. "Re-illuminate McCrag by 1900 hours, Southern local. I will speak with you then." He departed.
"Where is first on the list today, Consul?" asked Dantioch.
Forsha held up a hand. A clerk brought forward a sheaf of papers bound loosely in a folder. The Consul flipped through the binder and sighed wearily.
"Orders for the oligarchs of Thraya," he said. 30 lines, immediate response required."
The clerk read out the queries for Thraya. One of Dantioch's own staff wrote them down. Carantine's tech priests adjusted their machines and redirected the Pharos to the Acropolis of the Deimos in Thraya's capital. Dantioch's aides had become adept at operating the Mechanicum devices that moderated the Xenos technology, allowing Dantioch to concentrate on focusing the communications beam. Sometimes Pollux took his place. 3 other legionaries besides were being trained in the operation, but none of them had the finesse that Dantioch had developed. When he was on the stage, the beam was brought to bear quickly. What took the time was the personnel side of the operation. Human beings were forever the weak link in every chain. Ships could get to McCrag easily enough by following the light of the Pharos, but they could not easily return home, and so Gilliman had ordered that the Pharos be used for direct communication with his fiefdoms. The Pharos could only be focused on one location at a time. It could not bridge the gap between third parties so that they might be left to get on with their affairs. Therefore, the entire administrative business of Imperium Secundus went through the cave at the peak of Mount Pharos. Together, Dantioch and Gilliman had created a timetable allotting each of the worlds, outposts and fleets of Ultramar a set time for communication. It worked to a certain degree, but the exigencies of war disrupted this often. If communication from Sotha was not expected, heralds at the focal points had to fetch their masters. Then questions would be taken and answered, replies and reciprocal queries noted down, contact re-established with McCragg, and the matter of the report passed on, discussed with Forsha or others of the High Senate, and if necessary, acted upon. It took hours, but it was better than nothing. For the remainder of the day, Dantioch processed the woes of the 500 worlds. Pleas for aid, reports of minor enemy incursion, and dangerous levels of psychic incidents on two worlds made up the most urgent. Often, the petitioners were angry and afraid. Frequently, they attempted to get Dantioch to reveal the nature of the device they utilized, and asked repeatedly over its provenance and location. Rarely was the news good. Entirely by chance, Dantioch had become the linchpin that held Ultramar together. Even for a man of his will and dedication, it was mentally exhausting. A chrono chime cut short the last conference hours later. Dantioch withdrew the beam from the furious polymarch of Aphos and sent the alien beacon to alight upon the chapel of memorial again. After a few words with Forsha, the officio Ultramara was efficiently disassembled, leaving the chapel's ruin quiet. Dantioch gritted his teeth as he stood and left the central point of Prime Location Alpha. A day in the chair left him stiff. The play of his muscles and bones as they were reawoken provoked a storm of protest from his nervous system. And still, the day's work was not yet done. Servitors stepped forward unbidden to remove the throne to the side of the chamber. The Chapel of Memorial remained displayed in the focus field. It appeared real. It was real, he reminded himself, not an image. Dantioch's officials filed out, leaving a skeleton mechanicum crew to mine the Pharus's machines. Dantioch looked them over himself and gave his mark to the duty orders, pacing all the while to work the pain out of his back. He did not notice Pollux waiting at the back of the room until he spoke.
Barabbas,
said Pollux.
Ah, you have arrived already. I've been watching the whole session. It is important for me to understand.
You saw the purple face of Lord Espon, then?
I did. I do not envy you, my friend. I am no diplomat. I would likely have shouted back.
I'm not a diplomat either. We seldom get to choose our roles,
Dantioch coughed. He could not help wincing and holding his side.
You should rest, Barabbas. Let me take the conference tomorrow.
I will be fine, Alexis. I will rest tonight. First, let us go and investigate the damage we have done.
You told them about Inuit, but you did not tell them about my sighting of Lord Dorne,
said Pollux, falling in beside his friend.
I did not.
Why?
You know why. Do not worry, I will. And I thank you if you will hold your peace.
News of that magnitude should only be given to the Primarch.
Which one? Said Pollux. These lords of other legions are strange to me. How we can keep secrets from one at the command of another concerns me.
Do we tell the Lion? The Angel? What if Gilliman orders us to keep this from his brothers? We will be complicit in many lies. I do not like this secrecy. To be the master of communication is to know everything, said Dantioch. We are neck deep in the schemes of others. Our time here has been enlightening. To be a warrior again, said Pollux. A thought I have often, said Dantioch wryly. This is not the kind of war I am used to fighting, said Pollux.
He was as majestic as a god carved in marble, but there was something boyish to his features, and when worried, he could not escape an unintended look of petulance.
As little as I like it, I believe. The Lion's reasoning was sound. To reveal what happened to the neophyte Obadiah might well have led Lord Gilliman to stop our experimentation.
And you hold your tongue now for the same reason, I think.
Dantioch laughed and regretted it. He coughed loudly, fighting the spasm back down into the cage of hooks his chest had become.
You know me too well. I meant what I said. I will tell Lord Gilliman, but only face to face.
We do not wish to swamp him with rumour before he has the facts before him.
Pollux gripped his friend's arm and turned him gently to face him. Pollux was a giant among space marines and towered over Dantioch's injury-twisted form.
Swear to me that we will not become embroiled in shadow games. I will not become caught in the bickering of brothers. We must tell him. It is too important not to.
You might have been seeing nothing, Alexis. Ghosts walk these stages when the Pharos is untuned. Not all of them.
Swear to me, said Pollux. Please, Barabbas.
I swear, Barabbas said.
This insistence of Pollux's was taxing his patience a little. Through the chamber mouth, he could see onto the promontory. The sun shone redly there.
It is almost sunset. We must hurry if we are to inspect the damage with the benefit of the evening light drain. There is a theory that I wish to put to the test.
Pollux released the warsmith.
Very well.
Pollux followed Dantioch from the chamber, carefully matching his speed to his friend's halting pace. They followed a twisting route out of primary location Alpha. Many branches of Mount Pharos's cave system had been equipped with walkways to bridge the numerous deadfalls, pits, and chasms that broke the network, but not all. The metal shook and rattled on its pins under their feet. Against the smooth luster of the stone, the walkways seemed primitive. Dantioch chided himself against setting the technology of the Xenos above that of mankind, but faced with such evidence, it was hard to resist. For the most part, they descended. The shiny black stone of the Pharos's winding mechanisms closed in on them. They went as far as they could on the human additions to the system. 5 minutes before the sun was due to set, Dantioch unlatched a gate in a section of walkway railing and stepped with difficulty down onto the black rock. Pollux tensed behind him, reaching out a hand to steady the warsmith.
The stone is not so slick that I will fall, Alexis, Dantioch said sharply. I am broken, not helpless.
My apologies, said Pollux. He withdrew his hand.
Dantioch regretted his words.
Alexis, I apologize. A brother should never scold a brother for his concern. Your care makes me aware of my condition, and it is that which angers me, not you. It is I who should be sorry. I am tired. Our burden is great, even for such as us.
He grasped Pollux's forearm in friendship.
Follow me. The section I wish us to inspect is this way.
They went along the lip of a crevasse whose modest meter width hid a 200-meter chasm. The glassy lip to it and the black, light-absorbent quality of the stone made the edge uncertain, even to a space marine's eyes. A tension safety line ran along the wall, harnesses clipped to it, waiting to be used, but the legionaries disdained them. They headed further into the mountain, following a tunnel that narrowed minutely but steadily. The crevasse thinned, becoming a fissure centimetres across. The Pharos's tunnels were frigid. A constant breeze blew upwards through much of the network, and its defiance of thermodynamics was one of the many strange things about the mountain. Drawn from the warmer lowlands, this air should have held a higher temperature than the air at the peak. But the moment the damp coastal winds entered the structure, they became chilled. Humidity was well below its expected levels also. The moisture load of the air dropped with every metre one travelled upward. By the time the wind exited the summit, it had been sucked dry. They had descended far from primary location Alpha, but were still far above sea level. At that altitude, most of the moisture had been depleted. The air, hooting out of the narrow gap in the floor, brought with it a sharp dryness that stretched the skin of the nostrils. The tunnel grew darker. Soon all that Dantioch and Pollux could see were the grey shapes of each other against pronounced blackness. Every time Dantioch reached out to the tunnel wall and met rock, he was surprised, for the place was so devoid of light his eyes told him to expect nothing. For a quarter kilometre they went, the tunnel narrowing until they had to bow their heads. The gap in the floor became so thin that the mountain wind sang through it with an aggressive melancholy. They turned a twist in the tunnel, and a bright arc lamp suddenly flooded a tall, domed space 20 meters high. A black cavity opened up into a second, identical chamber, side by side with the first, so that the rooms formed a structure resembling a pair of lungs. At the center of the light, the constituent mineral crystals of the rock glittered coldly, but the periphery of the illumination was sudden, unnaturally weakened by the stone. The portable generator powering the light buzzed annoyingly. Next to it, a servitor stood sentry. As they approached, it swung its entire body round to face them.
"Warsmith, Captain, greetings."
The voice was human, but devoid of all feeling. Blank eyes as round and silver as coins regarded them.
"What is your command?"
"No command. Continue, Unit 992.
Compliance."
Dantioch led Pollux to the wall.
"See, Alexis, here is a damaged section."
The servitor dutifully waddled aside to allow them close. Dantioch showed Pollux a network of pressure cracks crawling up the stone in a pattern similar to the diamond web of a fishing net. Small fragments of shattered stone were trapped in the lines of the web, ready to pop free at the slightest motion.
"Shearing effect. The Pharah shook the mountain," said Pollux. "I shook it," he added wonderingly.
"Indeed.
Can we repair it, Barabbas? Do we even need to?"
"I'm not sure, but not because it has no effect on the mechanism's operation. That is why we are here."
"I do not understand. You're being oblique, my friend."
"If my hypothesis is correct, you will need no explanation from me once our observation is done. Please deactivate the lamp, 992.
"Compliance,"
said the servitor moronically. It stumped around and shut off the generator with a clumsy hand. The buzzing silenced, and the mountain's weight suddenly pressed in. The muted sound of the drafts blowing round its corridors took on the seeming of a mighty respiration, as if Mount Pharos were a giant slumbering away the eons. Once, neither space marine would have lent credence to such imaginings. Mental images, they would have said, the human mind constantly alive to analogy in its quest for understanding. No longer would they so lightly dismiss these notions, not when the galaxy was plagued by the impossible. Dantioch checked a chronometer in his mask display.
3 seconds.
The stone of the mountain was in all respects ordinary, a fine-grained basalt squeezed from the mantle under an ancient ocean, except where the Xenos architects of the Pharos had engineered it into that smooth, glossy black. Light did not shine as it should within the tunnel network. For the most part, it was quickly absorbed by the treated stone. At sunset and sunrise, the opposite was true. The Song of the Mountain was one of the planet's finest spectacles. Dantioch had seen every manner of terror and wonder, and still the light song of the Pharos arrested him. As Sotha's sun sank below the distant Black Rock Mountains, the last rays of the day hit the westward-facing apertures of Mount Pharos. This light was not sucked away, but reflected, intensified, and re-emitted, redoubled. Golden luminescence ran through the cavities of Mount Pharos, seeming languid as water poured from a ewer. Light slopped round corners, ran down curling tubes, flooded the floors of broad chambers, and gleamed from the unknowable depths of the deepest pits. It penetrated every centimetre of the endless tunnels. When it lit upon the great machine hall of the quantum pulse engines, it shone brightly. Re-energized, it sped on to fill the mountain from top to bottom, save in some few places. There were several enormous voids in the mountain. Into these the light did not go. From within them, it appeared not to shine at all. Dantioch could not calculate how this occurred, and the light's sluggishness was no illusion. It was slower. It ran at less than 70% of its usual speed. Dantioch could not even infer from the characteristics of the phenomena their purpose or cause. Neither could Magos Carantine. But where Carantine grew frustrated, if the blurts of angry binaric he emitted were anything to go by,
Dantioch saw something beautiful.
The light rushed into the twin-lobed chamber with an audible sigh. To experience the effect in primary location Alpha was to witness magnificence. To see two worlds hazed by honeyed light was a privilege. To be deep within the mountain during the light song was a different affair, bringing with it an intimacy with the structure that concerned Dantioch. As he had discovered during his recent explorations, when the light bathed his body in the tunnel, the calming effect of Mount Pharos reached its fullest, and for a moment he could forget his pain. Feelings of the righteousness of what he was doing suffused the warsmith, a balm to his tortured soul and body. In his mind's eye, he saw himself in primary location Alpha, all the mysteries of the Pharos unlocked, and the way open for the avenging sun to end the war. Horus brought to heel, and the name of Dantioch's own legion redeemed by his actions. Fantasies, mountain dreams, all who spent any time around the peak had them. Only some proved true, and Dantioch was under no illusion whether his would be among them. He held up his hand before his eyes, shielding them against the glow so that he might examine the effect upon the stone's fractures. As the golden wash drained through the tunnel into the chamber, another illumination flickered around the sharp edges of the cracks, a greenish sparkle emitted by the minerals of the stone. The event ceased. The light went out. The green sparkle lasted a moment longer, then faded. Dantioch dropped his hand.
Light, 992, ordered Dantioch.
The stark light of the lamp snapped back on.
Do you see?
He said, excitedly, running ironclad fingers over the cracks. Pollux peered at the wall.
The cracks! They have closed!
The network of lines in the rock was noticeably smaller. Once joined into a diamond web, many of the cracks were now isolated. All were narrower. The freestanding fragments were no longer jarring imperfections, but had become only cracks themselves, drawn back into the rock.
This is what I wanted to test. My hypothesis is correct. The material is self-healing, said Dantioch.
Has this not been noted before?
I have only recently observed it. Strangely, it is not apparent around the alterations we have made to the fabric. No anchoring bolts spat forth or gaps closed where we have cut through.
Dantioch touched the damage.
But another sunrise, and this will be as good as new. Is it because it is unintended damage, I wonder? Is it another facet of the Pharos's empathic functionality? The more time I spend here, the more amazed I become.
Pollux said nothing. He was more suspicious of the Pharos's mysteries, and of a character where he would not hide his disquiet.
We should have expected this. The artifact is old.
We should.
Continents move, seas rise, stone cracks, said Dantioch. The exterior of the mountain shows every sign of natural weathering, but there is none within.
There were a few places on the surface where the stone had eroded, leaving tube mouths slightly proud of the rock, or exposing their perfectly curved exteriors to the sun. But there was not so much as a chip in the black stone.
If the Pharos is only 1 million years old, the mountain will have known its share of earthquakes and cataclysm, and I believe it to be immeasurably older than that.
Dantioch tapped the rock.
An oversight on all our parts. I thought it only unnaturally perdurable. The finish of the stone is still beyond us.
Apparently it is more than merely lasting, said Dantioch.
And now we know why.
This discovery is important. We can attempt another long-range sounding if it is self-repairing.
The note of doubt grew in Pollux's voice.
I am concerned by such a capability. What else might it do?
Your unease aside, this makes the proposition of incidental damage less of a concern, my friend. But like so much else, we have no good idea of the properties of this mechanism. There may be a point it cannot be pushed past. Unit 992, monitor the cracks. Give me interrupt picked capture, one image every minute. Then we will be able to calculate the speed at which the damage is repaired.
Compliance, said the servitor.
It turned on the spot and stared fixedly at the wall.
Until then, we had better not do anything rash, said Dantioch. Not until we have had the opportunity to communicate with Lord Gilliman. This is something he should know of, and soon.
He looked up at the wall again.
Intriguing.